everybody. Welcome to another episode of the OIG Roundtable. As always, here with my partners in crime, Matt Kachansky, retired special agent in charge from the OIG, the retired Northeast UPIC director and the senior director of our payment integrity team, and Wade McFall, retired assistant special agent in charge from LA. He's wearing his North Face because for some odd reason he chose in retirement to move back to Wisconsin where he was reared. And after a 40-year absence, he moved back and snow last week in Wisconsin, even though it's spring on the map. So, you know, you reap what you sow.
Yes, I do.
Yeah, it's okay. it's all right, Wade. It'll be summer tomorrow in Wisconsin. Two seasons in Wisconsin.
Yeah. Snow. Summer for a week.
Snow and not. Yeah, I think summer this year falls on July 12th.
Yeah,
and then you're back. During that week,
winter and road repair.
Yeah, winter and road repair. During that week of summer, people are just like out of their minds. Like, you know, you're out there mowing four times a day. You're trying to get in 1 week, what people get in 3 months, I guess, right? I get it. So, the other day there was the pharmacy space continues to see FWA as always. We're seeing, obviously, and we're going to hold off on talking about this, but, you know, obviously the big roundup that was just done in the hospice space in California, and now the reinvigoration of fraud, waste, abuse efforts in the home health and hospice space. To us, this is not a mystery because we've been working on these cases for a lot of our plans, but we are going to talk about that probably in the next week or two. But today, we want to go over, there was a press release the other day this one is a barn burner of any sort, but out of Detroit, pharmacy owner pleads guilty to fraud involving Medicare, Medicaid, and commercial payers, $1.9 million or $2 million for essentially false claims, submission of claims for pharmacy-related drugs that weren't dispensed. The thing that's interesting about it is that this was kind of your most basic fraud. Scripts that didn't exist, medications that weren't dispensed. So we're not even talking about diversion. We're not even talking about generic substitution. We're talking about like the most basic of things. Submitting a claim for a prescription that didn't exist. No inventory to support it, nothing. Like, you know, pretty straightforward kind of fraud. But what makes this a challenge is that it kind of stays under the radar when it's like that, because you're not dispensing things to people that they didn't need, want, or ask for. There's no prescription that they're getting. And, you know, Wade, you worked for a little bit in retirement. You know, you worked on some Medicare contracts doing some of this. And, you know, the one thing that always becomes a challenge in pharmacy fraud cases, number one, is it's a point of sale transaction. The pharmacy puts in the information, you know exactly what your copay is at the time, and then you pick up your prescription, that's it. You don't get an explanation of benefits. You don't get any other documentation that shows what was paid to the pharmacy, unless you proactively go in to your plan's portal and do some of that research and see. But if you're not really getting the prescription or anything, you don't know. I mean, you know, typically you go to the pharmacy, you get a prescription, you walk out, you look at the piece of paper that says, you make your copay of whatever it is, and then you walk out and you say, oh, my insurance saved me X number of dollars. You don't really see that. But one of the things that we know that occurred in this case from doing some research, and when I say us doing some research, we mean Matt, was that this case started as an anonymous complaint to the state tip line. And, you know, Wade, we see complaints all the time. Let's forget OIG, because those complaints go to an entirely different group within OIG and we don't see them until later. But, you know, plans all have hotlines. Medicare has a hotline, right? HHS TIPS is the hotline for the OIG. People call 1-800-MEDICARE. But SIUs all have TIPS. And, you know, from your days as an ASAP, but also here seeing them, they could be unbelievably detailed. In a good way, unbelievably, or they could be unbelievably lacking information. You know, the one that says Dr. Smith commits fraud is probably not going to be dealt with the same way. So, you know, we have to guess because we don't know. We have to guess this one had a level of detail that was important. But for me, the thing is that when you've got an entirely phantom build, now, you know, versus services not rendered, right? You can have a phantom build where the patient never walked in the door of the place. It's an entirely fabricated claim that gets submitted. There's really no paperwork for it on one end where you can actually look at anything other than seeing a claim was processed. Those are challenging cases because there's nothing out there. You don't know what claims are real. You don't know what claims may not be real. All you've got is essentially a billing history. And if you have maybe a non-detailed complaint or whatever, but the less information you have, obviously the greater the challenge in being able to do it. But in the pharmacy space, because there is no explanation of benefits or there is nothing for a patient to get, it can really create a huger challenge in the pharmacy space because as a point of sale transaction, there isn't a lot of information to begin with.
Right. And in the SIU space, you know, you're limited as to what tools you have as compared to like an OIG situation where they have subpoena power. They can do search warrants. So if there's no, as far as records and stuff, you're not going to have the ability to do that. So you have to really rely on talking to members, to beneficiaries, interviews. Basically, it comes down to going to the source and find out instead of comparing, you know, inventory records to show that that they had the product on hand. You just have to talk to the member and find out, did you get this prescription? Do you take these meds? You know, the basic questions that you would ask, you know, is this prescribed by your physician? You know, if so, you know, you can ask for any records they may have. Again, there's limited records in this type of a case, but if they're claiming that they do take it and it was prescribed by their physician, you can ask for any, you know, maybe even a EOB that shows that they at least went to this physician and they have this condition. But again, because of the limited tools that you have, you really have to boil it down to talking to the member. And in these days when most of the SIU work is remote, it can be difficult to do interviews over the phone as opposed to showing up and, you know, talking to somebody sitting across the table from them. It's definitely a different approach, but that's really what it boils down to, is you have to talk to the members, talk to the beneficiaries, and get as much information details that you can from them.
And unfortunately, this could be one of those cases where a couple of things. One, I think sometimes the juice may not be worth the squeeze at the end, right? You may go down all this path and get nothing. The other one is trying to find the beneficiaries or the members or whoever you're talking to who might have actual information about something that's of value. So you may have to invest a lot. Now, again, not making this the sales pitch, but our national on-site and our national footprint of surveillance and investigators can really help to alleviate some of that kind of mechanical piece of having to do it. Because at the end of the day, one of the things that might actually turn out to be of value is you might actually find a member who got a prescription that they didn't need or different, you know, or didn't want. In this case, I think the facts of this case are a little bit different. In this case, it looks like nobody got a prescription. So in this case, you're going to have a bunch of people who are going to tell you, and this is something where over the phone you can achieve this, where the person is going to say, no, I never got this medicine. No, I didn't ask for it. No, I don't know who this doctor is that ordered it. No, I don't use this pharmacy. Or yes, I use this pharmacy, but I never got this prescription, something like that. But in other cases where we're talking maybe a pharmacy that does a lot of mail order, where people may actually get it, the value of actually speaking to a person is when the person says, oh, well, I'll be right back. And they come back and there's a box. And in that box are 30 prescriptions that they didn't ask for or want, or say, yeah, I thought that Dr. Jones was working with my doctor, you know? And so you've got to kind of weigh out what that is based upon. The key part, though, Wade, is going to be what's the allegation? What are the facts that you've got so far, right? If it's mail order, then there's a greater chance that someone actually got something because it's a mail order pharmacy and that's their business model. But in this case, it looks like this was a local run pharmacy in which the owner in his plea, right, admitted to all of this. But in this case, it's probably because he's a local pharmacy. You might actually get a little bit better response in your interviews because people are going to say, yes, I use this pharmacy unless this guy's stealing the identities and he's just saying, well, Wade McFall is one of my patients, I'm just going to make up a prescription for something for him.
Yeah.
And obviously, I think one of the things from data, which will be good, is, are we talking about, we don't know this because the press release did not disclose the drugs. But one of the things that I would want to know for sure is I would want to look and see, what are my top 10 drugs that this pharmacy is billing for? Dispensing and billing, not the same, right? What are the top 10 drugs that this pharmacy is billing for? Because that's going to help you. Are we talking about high dollar drugs? Are we talking about specialty drugs? Are we talking about maybe an HIV drug or a chronic condition drug? I use HIV because those are very expensive drugs. And you typically see a lot of drug diversion with a lot of those. But is it a high dollar drug? Is it a niche condition? Not necessarily maybe an orphan drug or a specialty, but is it something where people don't routinely have this condition? And when you call up the person and say, hey, did you get a prescription for XYZ to treat your blah, blah, blah? And the person is like, what is blah, blah, blah? Well, blah, 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 by the way, is a very specific medical condition. Only a few people have it. It's related to yada, yada, yada. And people have either blah, 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 yada, yada, yada. So sometimes people have these, you know, they clearly don't have these conditions. And so as a result of not having them, they're going to say, well, I don't even know what that medical condition is. So, you know, you can kind of see where that goes. But it really is in the pharmacy space. I think pharmacy investigations can be a challenge in some ways. But, you know, in other ways, like this one to me would be a challenging case as it from the SIU perspective, because there were no prescriptions dispensed. And so you have to, you're finding the needle in the haystack and you can find it. You just have to realize that you're going to spend a fair amount of time interviewing people to get to the people, because we don't know what prescriptions were not dispensed, particularly if they're using maybe a more common drug than other things. The other thing too is, if you look at a history, is this a drug where the patient has never gotten it before? Is it from an ordering doctor that they've never seen before? So there's some pieces of the puzzle you have to work on, you know, to get to that. But Matt, you did a little bit of, thanks by the way for being our intern on this. We really appreciate that. But
found my niche.
Yeah, I mean, you know, everybody has a goal in life, and I appreciate you've had so many jobs. It's good to find that your goal is to just be you're like the Robert De Niro of advice, the intern. But one of the things that you found, because there wasn't a lot out of this, but one of the things that you did find was that the defendant in the case that we're talking about, who's the owner of the pharmacy, pleaded guilty. And it turns out that his co-defendant is his brother, who has been charged but has not pleaded guilty and was the pharmacist in charge. So while we don't know the backstory on some of this, we can read some tea leaves and we have some thoughts on this. But it also gives you some other ideas as to where this investigation is going.
It's not going to be a happy Thanksgiving at this family's house, I think, because I think one is going to be turning on the other here. But the owner of the pharmacy probably is the one submitting the claims. Maybe that's why they charged him first and he's cooperating. And now the brother might be the one that created the scripts and actually submitted the billing or the super bills or whatever's in the pharmacy to generate the claims. So it's probably they got the guy on the hook for actually doing the submission, and now they're looking to have him cooperate against the person that generated the prescriptions themselves. So that's going to be interesting. And going back to the data, yeah, looking for those patterns are probably clearer after the fact, now that the tip came in. But there is probably a pattern of new scripts for patients that didn't have the diagnoses that fit this script, or a new ordering physician or an ordering physician outside the specialty that ordered this drug. So there were probably leads in that data that probably were pretty hard to detect. But it's probably still there. But now that you see the total picture, is like, oh yeah, this is clear. This person, so to identify those beneficiaries and members, it might be easier now to say, okay, this person never saw this physician, never had this diagnosis before, right, never got this drug. Let's go talk to them.
Well, so the other piece too,
them better.
The other piece too, when you read the press release, it's $1.9 million between Medicare, Medicaid, and commercial. What the press release doesn't tell you is what's the time period.
It didn't. None of them did.
So the question is, are we talking about 1.9 million over 3 months, or are we talking about 1.9 million over 4 years or 5 years, right? So that's the first thing. And so with 1.9 million, it makes you wonder, are the drugs that they were billing across Medicare, Medicaid, and commercial,
it actually were they lowered? Does.
What's that?
It actually does say it's a 5 year period.
Oh, 5 year period. Sorry.
Yeah. Sorry. Yeah.
I'm just looking at it myself. Yeah. Five year period. So we're talking about $2 million over 5 years. So we're talking 200,000.
Yeah.
Right. Couple hundred thousand. 400,000 a year over 5 years. So $400,000 is a lot, but it may not be a lot if it was spread out across, you know, 300 members. The thing too is, which kind of helps you, is if the pharmacy only had a universe, remember, as a mom and pop pharmacy, the number of patients that they have is not going to be infinite. If it's a neighborhood pharmacy, it's going to be one where they're probably having a fair amount of residual patients. So, you know, the first thing that you'd want to look at is who are the top, say, 10, 20 members at that pharmacy? Because you got a good shot that if their average number of members in a given year, patients, is 500, if you're picking 30 across, you know, that's gonna help you, right? You're gonna come up with some numbers there. The other thing too is, at $400,000 a year, you know, what are the drugs that are in question? I can't imagine that these guys were out there doing bogus prescriptions for $10 medications like amoxicillin or something like that, right? You got to be thinking that it's got to be higher dollar drugs, because if you're doing it for a $15 or a $10 drug, for $400,000, you're gonna have to do that for every patient that walks in, every patient that they have, right? Because now you're it's death by 1,000 paper cuts. So you have to think in terms of what are the drugs that are gonna be in question. So you got to think about, from a data perspective, I would be thinking about, what's my threshold? I'm looking at drugs that are probably no less than a couple hundred bucks to start with. And I'm probably looking at patients that are the more frequently visited patients that are there to start with. Just because for 400 grand, it's got to either be high dollar amount or higher dollar amount drugs, whatever that definition is. And it's also got to be a large volume of people, because this is a mom and pop pharmacy. It's, you know, if they're bringing in $5-6 million, something is not right to bring in that much money. But yeah, I think, Matt, you're right. It is not going to be a happy Thanksgiving.
No.
Someone's cooperating against someone else. And yeah,
it's Cain versus Abel here. But the one thing to remember also is, this was the result of an anonymous tip that came into the state health department, and who then referred it to the FBI. When I was a young OIG agent, so back when, you know, before computers, I spent a lot of time as duty agent, you know, and would get these anonymous calls and letters. Don't discount them, you know. Wade is absolutely right. There has to be enough detail and facts to be able to look into them. But some of them can hide some major frauds within, you know. I'll give you an example of two. One was anonymous complaint saying one doctor avoided his exclusion by billing under another doctor's provider number, you know. And named the doctor, so it was easy to see, and found out that, yeah, there was a year's worth of time when one was excluded for loss of license.
Mm-hmm.
All of his patients shifted to his son, who billed for those patients. And then after the license was reinstated and the exclusion was lifted, went back to the father.
Right.
You know, so the pattern was there to follow. So it was a good anonymous complaint. Turned out we got one conviction on the son, the father killed himself. The anonymous source was the father's second wife. He was a bigamist. second wife found out about the first, told us about it, you know, told us about the pillow talk, and ended up at trial. And the day before the trial, the father offed himself rather than face the second wife who was going to testify against him.
Death over the second wife. So the thing that's interesting, the thing that's interesting about that, Matt, is so the pattern is not, I would expect that pattern, right? The son and the father are in practice together. The father gets excluded. The patients have to go somewhere. But the thing that's kind of cool is you now have your pool of interviewees. Very easy, because now you just go and interview them and then you get your answer. You know, I had a very similar case. We had a provider that was excluded, cardiologist from a large case that we did here in New Jersey. And it was the same thing. Provider was excluded. He was working at a practice and he was supposed to only be seeing the commercial patients that he wasn't terminated from. He still had his license. And when we went and interviewed Medicare members, we learned that he was seeing the people that were there. The employees told us he was seeing the people and all of that. So you kind of have your pool of applicants, because we saw the same thing. We saw the shift in the patients, and then we saw that, you know, that shift back. And so that, you know, the data is something you have to look at. And anonymous sources can oftentimes provide really good information. You always have to do at least a basic vet. I mean, look, I agree. If an anonymous tip comes in where the tip says Dr. Kachansky is committing fraud, and that's the end of it, you leave it at that. But if there's some level of granularity where you can at least run some data and do a few things, even if you're not going to work the case, you at least have to be able to be in a position to justify your actions. Why did you not open this case? You could say, well, saying Dr. Smith commits fraud gives us nothing to go on. But if you say, hey, Dr. Smith commits fraud when he builds this code and this is what he does, then you can at least look and say, well, he never built this code, or holy cow, he builds this code a lot, or whatever it may be. So you have to at least do something, because at the end of the day, if somebody on the regulatory side comes in and says, hey, you guys are closing up these cases, what's the story? You at least have something in your file that you can, you know, rely on.
Yeah, so it's give it a shot. I mean, the second one I had was a phone call from an 88-year-old woman who was saying she was in the hospital for a medical condition. They had a psych consult come in, and they did the psych consult, but then she said this psychiatrist billed every day after that while I was in the hospital, and I never saw him again. But then also another doctor in the hospital impregnated her as she's 88 years old. And so the psych consult, there was a reason for the psych consult.
Yeah.
And this woman called me every day, giving me more and more details about the doctor that impregnated her and this Russian sea captain that brought her over to this country and many, many other stories. But that psychiatrist only saw her once and billed every day. And then I saw in the pattern that he was the on-call psych for this hospital. And he had that same pattern with every patient in the hospital that he was called in for a consult. Hmm. So while this woman was in need of psychiatric help, she was right.
Right.
So you can't discount the facts when they're just clouded by other circumstances.
The lunatic ravings of a madman may have only been the lunatic ravings of a madman for 99%, but the 1% may have been legitimate. Yeah.
Tale told by an idiot, signifying nothing.
True story. Nope. All right, guys, good stuff. It's going to be interesting to see what happens with the other guy, whether he decides to plead or not. He has to obviously know that his brother is now cooperating against him. That's interesting. Yeah, keep the sharp knives away.
Everybody, I'll carve the turkey. Yeah.
Thanksgiving. Everybody's getting a hungry man. you need a plastic spork. That's what you're getting for your before you dip into your cobbler. You're getting.
I still want to know what a giblet gravy is.
Exactly. So interesting. So while I say, you know, at the end of the day, the wrap up is it's 1.9 million, and while it's not insignificant, you know, and you look at it relative to some of the cases that we're seeing today, 1.9 million isn't a ton of money, but you know, it's one of those things where that you have to make that, you have to make that statement. You can't just treat some of these as civil matters. You gotta kind of deal with it the right way. And you know, the other piece of it too, is at the end, depending upon what people's benefits are, if they're a Medicare beneficiary, they start to run up into the donut hole and things of these other issues on catastrophic coverage. So there are financial implications outside of just, you know, maybe hitting thresholds and things of that sort. So it's going to be interesting to see if this guy ultimately pleads or if he goes to trial and the number one witness against him is his own brother. That's, you know, that'll be kind of weird. I don't know which side of the bar you, you know, which side defense or prosecution side the family sits on when they to the testimony. That's just kind of, it's an interesting one, but you know, we'll see what happens. So that's always good stuff, Matt. I appreciate you playing intern for this one as well. Good stuff. I mean, you know, you could, we could have a lot. We will be setting up weekly mentoring sessions with you.
Thanks. I need it.
And you know, we want to get you on the right path as you embark on maybe your third or fourth career.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're going to be, shout out to Jason Eisengrind. You're going to be the Jason Eisengrind, the second Jason Eisengrind of Advise. 7 more careers to go.
And I'm not ending up on cruise ships.
No one should ever end up on a cruise ship. No one should ever. So good stuff as always. And thanks to everybody for always tuning in. Again, newsletter every week. You'll get this. LinkedIn, you can get this. LinkedIn Lives every month. All of that after the fact. On our website and on our YouTube channel and on Spotify. So just go in there and just type in Advise Health and you will find all of that. So thanks everyone for tuning in and we'll see you next week on the next OIG Roundtable.
Thank you.
Thanks everyone.